Welcome to Leaders Upgraded, the place where people who want to upgrade and fast track their career, their life, and their leadership journey tend to gather. I am your host, Tanvi Gautam, and I shall be speaking to the top 10% of the world's leading authors, CEOs, coaches, and thinkers to bring you some of the best and brilliant ideas to fast track your way to success. Would you like an upgrade? Let's do this.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to the next session. Really important session. All sessions are important. This one I consider particularly important. The guest for this session is Pete Havel. He is the author of the book called The Arsonist in the Office. Yes, The Arsonist. Fireproofing your life against toxic coworkers, bosses, employees, and cultures. And I'm almost certain everybody who's in this audience has had some variation of their own toxic workplace cultures, bosses, employees. So this is going to be a really, really important question, you know, conversation. So thank you so much, Pete, for joining us.
Timmy, thanks for having me. I'm excited.
So I picked up this book as I was kind of curating all the different speakers, and I came across your book. First of all, I was like intrigued by the title because the arsonist is such a strong term to use, right? But it also had perfect 5-star reviews from like more than 50 people. So I was like really intrigued. I said, well, whatever he is talking about is resonating. So I picked up the book and I read it. And what a story you've been through. And I'm not going to tell that story because I'm going to let people pick up the book and see what it is. But let's just say you talk not from theoretical expertise or, you know, frameworks from the ether. You've been there, done that, walk the talk. But tell me, how rampant is this phenomena? How real is it, this business of toxic workplaces and coworkers? And like, what's the cost of something like this?
When I began to write the book, I had a hunch that I probably was not alone in my experience of dealing with that uber toxic, ultra toxic type of employee, the one that can take down an organization. What I'm finding is, as I go out and give speeches, they're everywhere because people come to me and have stories. And I'm sure you get this in your feedback on LinkedIn and elsewhere. There's a lot of people with stories. They may be in their job, it may be in their churches, in parent, teacher organizations, schools. There are people that fit that arsonist pattern that I talk about. And I think they're much more plentiful than you would think, frankly, because a lot of people haven't written books about them. So this may draw some more attention.
Yeah. So how do you define an arsonist or a toxic workplace culture? Because one of the things I realized as I was reading the book is that each of us, we have our own experience, and I have had my own experience of what a toxic boss or a toxic culture can look like. And I have got friends who behind closed doors will share stories that give you goosebumps and say, no, if you were not telling me this story, I would not believe that this is what's going on in this workplace, right?
That's right.
But I also realized that there is a huge amount of variance on what this actually might end up looking like in terms of the types of behavior that would fit your definition of the arsonist or the toxic workplace. So share with us a little bit about what these type of behaviors might be like.
Sure. The way I define an arsonist very broadly is somebody with the capacity to burn down careers, cultures, and companies. What that means in practice is somebody that has leverage within an organization that can shift the culture. They may be somebody who may be that serial accuser within the organization that's put pressure on leadership or on boards of directors. Somebody that does not have that brake on their car in their operations of how they do life, where they don't have any fear of consequences. And you find yourself in organizations, especially ones that are ethically compromised, that are afraid of the person that's willing to take a sledgehammer to coworkers, to just standard norms of behavior. And I found myself with what I describe as a perfect storm of a colleague that had made widespread accusations, had made legal threats, had dozens and dozens of people that ran in fear of what they might do next. And it not surprisingly affected other people's behavior. It affected the leadership's behavior because they were frightened of what might happen next.
Yeah. So, you know, it almost, as I was reading it, it sounded like a very, like a hostage situation where one person,
that's right,
and many times, you know, this could be a senior leader who they're tolerating in the name of, you know, he or she is a high performer, they're bringing in the big money, they're the ones with the client contacts, and this person is being tolerated. Everybody knows. It's kind of like an open secret that people know what's going on, but no one's really, really doing anything. So the person you encountered, I think, was like very big on all these traits. But I also noticed that you mentioned that there could be variations such as just verbal bullying in the office, or you're in a meeting and someone decides that. What are some of those more, maybe not so dramatic, but yet important type of variations when it comes to toxic workplaces or colleagues or office?
Yeah, bullying is a big one. An organization that allows retaliation. Saying something in a meeting. And I talk about how some of these have turned into whistleblower type of situations where somebody raises a concern about a practice that's taking place in the organization and they disappear. It causes huge ripple effects because people learn you don't speak if you have a differing opinion. So that can cause some serious problems, definitely to the culture, to productivity, you name it.
Yeah. So it sounds like, you know, the variations could be verbal attacks or bullying in the workplace, or, you know, people not having a voice to be able to speak, even when things are going wrong, and then it becoming like a part of the culture that that's just how we do it here. And then before you know it, I really like, I'm a fan of Star Trek as well. So that's that story when Lieutenant O'Hara brings that little fuzzy thing on board from a planet.
That's right.
It's exactly that. I mean, so for those of you who are not Trekkies, let me tell you the story. So the Starship Enterprise goes to another planet, and then Lieutenant O'Hara goes off board. She finds this really cute, cuddly little animal. And how harmless can a cute, cuddly animal be? And she brings it on board, and the Enterprise takes off. And then before you know it, it's kind of proliferating. It's eating their food. It's taking over the Enterprise. It's all over. It's like an epidemic. And I said, that's what it is. It's that one person that can just contaminate everything else that's kind of going on, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. And when the organization starts that path by creating two sets of rules, employees have one set of rules, everybody else has another, people figure that out pretty quickly. And that's really where a lot of trouble begins within a culture, is people understand that they can get away with more. And it starts having ripple effects throughout the organization.
Right. So, so when one finds oneself in the situation where it's toxicity coming from, you know, cultural behaviors or your boss or colleagues, co-workers, whatever it is, one's first instinct is to just get up and leave, because sometimes these interactions can be very, very draining. They can start impacting your mental health. They can completely mess with your sense of identity and professionalism and productivity and everything else. And you talk to lay people, they'll say you should just leave. Just find another job. This is not worth putting yourself through. And in your book, you really caution against that, you know, just up and leave kind of an attitude, which I found very interesting. So share with our listeners, why do you advise against it? And what should one be doing instead first?
Sure. Being in a toxic environment is one of the most difficult things people are going to encounter, in that you're spending more time with these miserable people in your company than your own family. So you're going to, what you face is difficult, but if you don't have another job to go to, and if the income is a key part of your, you know, what gets you through life, compounding that by becoming unemployed is going to make life worse, in that you're adding the stress to that. So what I caution people to do is, certainly if you need to get out because your health is being destroyed, if your mental health is at the point of breakdown, go. But if it's anything short of that extreme, the most extreme situation imaginable, take a deep breath and think through what that next step is going to be, because unemployment is no fun at all. You are going to be asked questions about why you left your last employer, And if the story is not a good one and pleasant one that you want to share, don't go quite yet. Make all the steps that you can to get a great job. Set your path in the way to be successful leaving, but cutting and running when it seems like you can't take it anymore, take a deep breath and really think through it and figure out if you're ready to not have a paycheck for a long time or the go through the uncertainty that comes with unemployment. I can tell you it's no fun.
Yeah, I completely agree that cut and run while it's the first instinct might need to be delayed if one can under the circumstances. What should one be doing instead? What would be some of the concrete things that you should be doing instead if you are able to have that, you know, holding pattern for a little bit?
Yes, certainly networking, getting your online profile up and going. If there are additional skills that you can gain, maybe you want to be in a job that would have you, for instance, doing public speaking, or you need new applications, software applications to understand to get that new job, get them now. Get them so you can compete for an even better job than you have at that time. Those are some of the things. And the other thing is when you're doing that networking or if you're going to meetings, if you're in a job where you can go off campus, take those as mental breaks to get out, get to know some new people, and use your job to build up your next job.
Yeah. So it may just be the catalyst you need to kind of relook at your job and your career, which I think might you know, you might get forced to do it because you're not thinking of changing careers or jobs or whatever else. But, you know, and I hear the story many times that people, because they decided it was not something that it was not a workplace that they could cope with, they left. And then it was a turning point almost in their life into what they wanted to end up doing next in their career and life. So I think what I'm hearing you say is to if you can just hold off on holding the plug and be a little bit more strategic about looking for that next role, whether it's like, you know, building cash reserves or networks and all that. Because the other thing that I was wondering was if you just up and left, right, from one of these places, many next employers are going to be asking you for like references.
Sure.
Where are you supposed to be even like getting those references and leaving all of a sudden? That's not going to be helping, right?
No, not at all.
So
it's going to put a hole on your resume. And if it is as toxic a situation as, you know, as we're discussing, who knows what your HR department may say, not the HR department, perhaps the hiring manager that you work for currently, what are they going to say about you? Or is it going to be that long, awkward silence when people are doing the reference checks? You just want to be as careful as possible.
Yeah. So I think what you're drawing attention to is taking a longer term perspective than what is unfolding in front of you. Because the truth is, when you're kind of with your back up against the wall, your first instinct is to fight or flight. And neither of this might be very useful under the circumstances. You may have to just hold off a little bit, reassess a little bit. And I really like what you said about, you know, creating that mental gap between where you are and, you know, retaining your sanity, because this can be such an all-consuming, emotionally draining experience, isn't it? Like if you don't have those sources of replenishment, chances are you going back and talking to your, you know, spouse or partner or friend or family or whoever they are. This is something that doesn't really leave your mind because you're living and breathing this all the time.
No doubt. It is all consuming, and people need those breaks.
Yeah. So, you know, do whatever it is to create like a lifeboat situation before you can get rescued by another big ship, so to speak.
That's right.
So, you know, there is a chapter in the book which talks about fireproofing and future-proofing your career for, and then you share some really good strategies in there on what you can really be doing to combat this other person that is being toxic or colleague that is being toxic. So tell us about some of the things one can start doing at the workplace, which strengthens one's position in the organization as it stands then.
Sure. If you're being targeted by someone or a group of people, first and foremost in the workplace, you better be as productive as possible. If a top performer is coming after you, you want to be a top performer so that people know your value. I come from a world of politics. One of the keys that you've got to do in politics is tell your story to others. Firmly believe that people need to do that as well, in that, especially in larger organizations, if no one has any idea what you do, they don't know, you know, they're not going to have a value for you other than just as another human being. So telling your story in subtle ways, not as a bragger, but as somebody that whose value is well known within the organization. Avoid gossips within the organization. Gossip is rampant, especially in toxic workplaces. Stay away from them, because it's one of the quickest ways to be targeted for attack, and it can hurt your reputation. Another thing that I talk about is documenting. If there are things happening within the organization that go against the cultural values, you're going to have to make decisions on whether you want to talk to anyone about what's happening to you. But making notes about what's occurring, I think that's very important. And then one of the biggest ones is making friends throughout the organization, building your support, again, with the political analogy, as broadly as possible, so that you have some allies throughout, because this is office politics in many ways. You want your supporters out there. And then minimize what can be said negatively about you. And what that means in the most broadest of terms is don't create opportunities for people to be negative about you and be correct. For instance, I know one of the things that happens within organizations when people are being targeted for dismissal is people's expense reports are looked through for the tiniest of fluctuations, anything that's wrong on there, any excessive reimbursement, et cetera, et cetera. Well, be ethical and make sure that you are a model employee, and that reduces the target that may be focused on you.
Yeah, those are.
I have about 20 in the book, but those are just a few.
I know, and they're really useful strategies too. And you know, this entire series, which we call the Career Intelligence Accelerator, it looks at things like networking and, you know, personal branding and things like that. And people underestimate the importance of these things till everything starts going south. Right? If nobody knows what you're doing, you don't have a reputation within the organization. Worse, outside it. People barely pay attention to what's happening within the company and their reputation, leave alone think about how they're being perceived by the industry or their colleagues outside the company and all of that. So when you have to call in your social capital, there isn't any.
That's right.
Who are you going to call on? Because, you know, this is this misnomer that all I have to do is hard work and it'll get recognized and rewarded, you know, in case anybody didn't get the email. It doesn't quite work like that. You know?
At some point you realize, whether it's in this situation or watching other people's challenges, nobody really cares about what you're doing unless there's a screw up or a huge positive event. Those two get noticed. Everything else, everyone's kind of blending into the wallpaper.
Yeah. And I like this idea of, you know, one, you know, this thing about, which is so counterproductive, right? Because just like your previous advice on you want to pull the plug but hold off, and then, you know, your advice about now is the time to really raise your productivity, because that's exactly what we're not wanting to do, because we are emotionally withdrawing, we are mentally, you know, being suffering. What we want to do is actually, we want, naturally are inclined to, is to lower our effort and hold back.
Exactly. And it's funny when you go on LinkedIn or any of the networking sites, or you can pretty well guess who is looking for a new job. They're very active. They're liking everything. They're posting. Why don't we do that when, as part of what we do as just a great professional, we become more attractive for potential other jobs. We can become an authority on a subject, we can be out speaking, we can be doing all of these different things, but most of us don't use that opportunity until we're looking for the next one. I say do it now. Do those things now and you're going to be better off.
Oh yeah, I totally agree. I mean, I have seen that pattern on LinkedIn as well. You know, people who suddenly we hadn't seen forever, are like posting and tweeting and reaching out. You know, it's so obvious. And, you know, everybody can see through it. Everybody can see through it. So it's like a career investment you make when you nurture your network or you know, help people that may not necessarily be able to help you, because you're creating that community around yourself, which is a community you rely on when things, you know, start going south, so to speak. And I have had my own experience of working with, I wish I had read your book at that time, but, you know, with with toxic people. And ultimately, I think it worked out for me. But I remember I had to take a couple of people into confidence. And the only reason I found, you know, the ability to speak to them was because they had seen the history of the good work that I was doing. They would have been willing to back me up and not, you know, because the other thing that happens is that sometimes when there is a power differential, right, the person who is being toxic or the bully in the office or whatever else, you know, it's one thing if it's your peers, but it's another thing if they're like a couple of levels above you. Because the tendency for people is to believe people, you know, who are more senior, who have more history, who have more networks than you if you don't have those networks and that reputation, isn't it?
Absolutely. And everyone that's in those situations is going to make their evaluation on, frankly, whether you're going to survive. If someone from a few levels up is really coming down hard on you in a job, people are looking at it and thinking, okay, do I go with the person that may be out of here in a week, or do I keep my mouth shut and watch it happen? But you don't want to be standing next to the person who has been handed the hand grenade and you know, supporting them if things are going to go badly. You just, that's not the way people work. And one of the most powerful things that I learned, and then I talk about it in the book, is out of all motivations in the workplace, self-preservation may be the strongest. And right and wrong sometimes doesn't matter to the person that's looking at it and thinking, you know what, if I get involved helping this ethical, moral, right person, but it cost me my job, people don't want to do that. And it's frustrating when it happens. You know, people's hearts are in the right place, but are they going to give up everything they have, the security they have, to help somebody else? Usually not. And I think that is more human nature than not.
Yeah. I remember I read this quote once, which I think I should find and post, you know, which said something like, you know, they came for, you know, people who had particular affiliations or worldview, and I didn't care. So, you know, I'm just going to just like, let's talk about vegans, right? Just for the heck of it. They came for the vegans. I didn't care. I'm not a vegan. You know, then they came for the, you know, the celiacs, and I didn't care. I'm not a celiac. And then it kind of goes down that line and said, and then they came for me. And there was nobody left who would come for me, because, you know, people have this attitude of, oh, but it doesn't interest me. It doesn't bother me. What they don't realize is that they're creating this culture which can become rampant. So what should be people doing, and then how people should be supporting others is a different conversation. But the reality of it is, chances are you may not have that support that you were counting on, so to speak. Right. So
that's right.
It can't be taken as a given. It's difficult, but is there anything one can do to avoid getting hired into this type of, you know, culture? Is there any, you know, and it may not always work, but are there some strategies to kind of look at some telltale signs and say, is this where I really want to work? Like, is there any due diligence one can do ahead of time?
I think so. And some of them are maybe outside of some people's comfort zones, but I'll give you a few. I know you have an international group of followers from around the world. So some of the websites I'll mention may be US-based, but we have Glassdoor that offers reviews, offers former employees and current employees the opportunity to review their employers. You can find out information from those types of sites. Certainly you have the people that just hated the job and hated everything about everything in the organization, and they may be as toxic as the culture itself. But you also see a lot of reviews on those types of sites that give you good information, especially if you see patterns. In looking for jobs, going on some of the social networking for business sites like a LinkedIn that will give you, you know, you type in the company's name and you can find out people that have worked there previously. If you really want to find out what the culture's like, call a few of those people. You can identify them and ask. They may not want to talk to you, or you may hear volumes. Another thing that the people can do is do Google searches or, you know, the internet searches for all sorts of keywords of XYZ company with lawsuit, XYZ company with harassment, toxic, and see what comes up. You may find nothing, which may be great, or you may find some things which will at least give you pause. The other thing, and I'll make this very quick, one of the things I found in my experience was I was very confident in my skills in terms of reading situations. And this job, what I talk about in The Arsonist in the Office, is the one time when that was really shaken, in that I saw some of the things that I experienced coming, but I kept on thinking that somebody within my organization was going to be watching out for me. And that turned out to be wrong. Where I'm going with that is everybody has blind spots. They may not know about them. And what I encourage people to do in a job hunt is have some friends that you look up to, are savvy people that you can go through your options and talk through these types of opportunities and ask them for their counsel. Because if you are undecided on whether this is a good job or not, having a group of friends that are going to ask you some tough questions that may do a little bit of digging of their own on different companies may give you some good things to think about. And you don't want to walk into that horrible situation in a toxic environment. But too many people, if they are without a job, have a little bit of desperation. And that's not a good thing to have in your mindset when looking at new jobs, because you want the paycheck, but frankly, you're not going to want anything else that goes with that paycheck. And you need to stay out of those as hard as it is to avoid the immediate gratification of the new job.
Yeah, because next thing you know, you've gone from the fire to the frying pan, and then
that's
even worse. And that is your tendency, to take the first available thing that comes your way, because you're kind of, you know, wanting to just kind of get out of that situation. I also think that, I think you may have mentioned this in the book, because like I was mentioning, I was just so outraged by the story that was happening to you that I was speed reading the book. It's like, I can't believe that this is how people can behave in the workplace. But sometimes looking up the social media profiles of people who you're going to be working with, in terms of, especially if they're on things like, you know, Twitter, because it's a little bit more informal than LinkedIn is, you can get a fairly good idea of a person's, you know, personality. And not always, because I think that sometimes people can pretend to be something they're not on social media. But if you kind of read long enough and you're looking for it, you can sometimes see patterns of what it is that this person's personality might be like. I mean, at the end of the day, one is just trying to do whatever due diligence one can. That's not to say that it will always work, but that could maybe just be another option. Try and get a sense of, you know, what they're tweeting, posting, saying, how they're showing up in interactions. I had this one person who I was going to meet. He was a senior person in an organization. And I wasn't doing it because I was going to join the organization, but I try and get a sense of, you know, the clients that I'm working with and say, well, what are they like? And I just realized that, whereas, you know, when it came to all things professional, this person had a very poised demeanor, but, you know, post the 6 o'clock saying, he had some very strong views on things that I was like, are you really saying that on social media? Like, should you be saying that on social media? So it's like, people let their guard down. They don't realize how many people are watching you. And
yeah. And that's a smart thing for everybody right now. Whether you're looking for a job or whether you're looking for a job and wanting to put your best foot forward, or you're looking at other people. Yeah, it's never good to be wanting to be high profile and create a good reputation, but also look like a train wreck on social media at the same time and say controversial things that, you know, sarcasm or dry senses of humor. I have a dry sense of humor, and I can put something in an email and the people that know me are like, hey, Pete's a funny guy. He meant it in the way we know him to. But you say something in a sarcastic way or something like that, people do not read sarcasm or dryness well. So it's just one example of why we need to be careful.
Yeah, I agree. So let's assume that, you know, you have decided that it is time to leave, and then you got yourself a job interview, you've done your due diligence, you're sitting across the interview table, and they ask the inevitable question, which is, so why did you leave? What do you do then? Because in your heart, chances are physiologically, right, that you are suddenly back in the space that you left because you are kind of re-experiencing those emotions of what it was like to have been there. But you're supposed to keep your calm and answer this question. So in your book, you advise one thing that you absolutely should not do, which is probably one's first instinct to do. And then there is you know, you made a suggestion on how you can navigate that conversation. So tell us what we should absolutely not do and how we could tackle it.
Absolutely. Don't trash your old boss, because your prospective new boss is going to understand that you may be saying that about them in a couple of years. So it also, I think, says something about somebody's awareness, their self-awareness that, okay, why do I want to be sounding like the angry employee? Mm. But the problem when people are in that situation, and do we have enough time for me to give the yeah. example of what I ran
yeah.
into?
Yeah, please.
So I won't spoil the end of my book, but things escalated and became very problematic for me, and I found myself looking for a new job. When I left that company, I had an interview, and I had worked with a consultant to find the perfect answer to addressing what I thought was an impossible answer to why did you leave your last employer, because my story was book-worthy, as you may know. I had quite an experience, and providing that answer would make heads explode. Providing no answer seemed bad, so what do I say? And so I went to a consultant who said, here's what you say. Pete, just tell them that you did everything you wanted to do in the last, in your previous job, and you just decided to move on. So I'm sitting in front of a search committee and for a great job, and I roll out that answer. I say, ladies and gentlemen, here's what I ran into. I had just done everything I wanted to, and it was just time to leave. And I'll never forget the chair of that search committee looking at me and saying, I'm not sure whether you're a quitter or a liar, but I can't take a chance on either. And you know what? They had a point in that I had done one of two things, just walked out, or I wasn't being straight with them. And so where I've landed is you have to have a certain amount of forthrightness and honesty in your answer. You certainly don't want to be saying anything that is going to have people frightened of either you or the experience you're in. So you don't want that. But you want them to know, first and foremost, a glimpse of you had a reason to leave, if you did. And then the other thing about that, what you did to make a situation better, to be a leader within this. And let me just give you a quick scenario. If I had to give that answer again today, my answer would probably be something along the lines of, I faced a situation that frankly, I could not tolerate any longer. I spent 3 years or 5 years, or whatever the amount of time would be, in that role. And I faced some challenges that I was not going to be able to get resolved, and went through my channels within the organization to get some things taken care of. And I reached a point where it was time to go. And I did, but I'm somebody that wants to find solutions to problems, and I just wasn't able to. It's a whole lot better than being silent and hemming and hawing. And there's not going to be a perfect answer to that, but being the person that sounds rational, problem solving, and not a former employer basher is going to be a lot better off than somebody that just spills it all.
Yeah. Well, I hope you asked that consultant for a refund, because that that answer was, you know, if you had told me that that's what he would have, I was like, nah, I don't think you should go with that. But <No. laughs> yeah. So I think it's important to kind of talk about it, but do a light touch on what might be, and shift focus on, you know, who you are and you know, how you take ownership and accountability. Yeah. Not
in what you're looking for in the next employer, which may help paint the picture of what happened without painting the picture. And you're looking for an organization with the strong leadership and values that you share and those types of things. And you haven't bashed your employer, but you may have sent the message that you're wanting to work for an organization that you can respect without disrespecting your previous employer.
Yeah, yeah. So I think you come across as more professional, because I think, you know, right, bashing coworkers or prior, you know, bosses or workplaces doesn't make you seem very, very professional. At the same time, I think people, you know, should, if it has been an experience that has left you, you know, very scarred, possibly maybe even seek counseling before they get into the interview and things like that. Because I think what the interview is not is not a therapy or a cathartic experience where you're like, oh, you have no idea. Let me tell you what this place was like. Because it is an emotionally charged experience. So you don't want to give in to that emotional surge that might end up happening. You're nervous about the job interview. You want to get the job, and then, you know, you haven't dealt with the emotions. So, you know, I think, pardon me for saying this, and this is a huge generalization. I'm going to be stepping into some controversy as I say this.
This is going to be good.
But I do feel that the masculine norms of dealing with emotions are different than the way sometimes women deal with their emotions.
Oh, yes.
It's a lot more permissible for women at times to, you know, to deal with having that, you know, emotional conversation than men, who are very often taught to, you know, men don't cry, or, you know, man up, or all those messages that are given to us constantly, or men who have to be in, like, who are the bread earners, you know, winners of the family, having to put up that I got my act together. And maybe you do. Maybe your family, you know, you're the emotional rock for your family for that. But you can't neglect your own emotional needs. This is a difficult experience you're going through. And if you need professional help, you need to go get that professional help. Not dealing with it doesn't make it go away, right?
No, it doesn't. And it was amazing in doing the research for this book that the toxic workplace experience, and I'm not a psychological professional by any means, but here's what I learned. There are a lot of effects from the toxic workplace that mirror post-traumatic stress disorder,
yes,
which surprised me. I didn't realize it, because frankly, I would never want to, you know, I'm not comparing myself in any way to somebody that's been in battle, but apparently the body treats the experiences very similarly.
Yeah.
I guess it's probably the best way to say that. And that was interesting to hear.
Yeah. No, and, you know, I say this in my book, and, you know, Brené Brown, whose work I really respect, she was the one who brought my attention to this. It's like, emotions you don't deal with, they don't go away. They will show up somewhere else and at very inappropriate situations and circumstances, because you didn't deal with it when you were supposed to have dealt with it. And, you know, I just posted on my social media thing, this other thing that I came across, which said, if you don't learn to say no and speak up, your body will teach you how to say no and speak up. Because the toxins are in the system, they're not really going anywhere, right?
Absolutely. The stress is going to come out in some way.
It is. So it's not something that we can take lightly. You know, thank you so much, Pete, for your time. This is a complicated and complex conversation. Nonetheless, it is one that needs to be had. And I think if there are people who are leaders who are listening to this interview right now, I think your book also has some really great suggestions on how to create workplace cultures that, you know, allow people to thrive. Because at the end of the day, an organization is a reflection of its leaders, right?
Absolutely. Leadership calls the shots on culture, and it all comes from there.
Yeah. So I would encourage everyone to really, you know, pick up Pete's book, whether, you know, if you're trying to figure out if you're in a situation which is toxic, you know, you might get some ideas. Again, no single formula works for every situation, but, you know, there are some great suggestions in there, very concrete suggestions in there. If you haven't been in a toxic situation, I am so glad for you. But I still think you should pick up the book, because I think forewarned is forearmed, as they say. It's kind of good to know. Or who knows, a colleague or a family member or a friend might be in a situation that you might read something in the book that could be of help to you. I guess what I'm saying is just pick up the book. Okay, so thanks so much, Pete. Really appreciate it. And, you know, thank you for getting your message out to everybody.
I appreciate it. Thank you, Tammy.
That concludes this episode of Leaders Upgraded. But wait, your journey is just getting started. Go to www.leadersupgraded.com for more insights, more inspiration, and more tools to continue the journey. And if you have someone who you would like to nominate for the podcast, or a particular topic you'd like us to cover, then also visit www.leadersupgraded.com and let us know. If you like this episode, please do share it. Please do subscribe to the podcast. And I look forward to continued upgrades with you. Take care.